My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the November 23rd Forum featuring Jamie Dimon, the Chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, I engaged in a fireside chat with Jamie Dimon, Chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase. The conversation focused on America's role in a globally competitive landscape, the company's commitment to racial equity and their investment in New England, and lessons on leadership.
Welcome, everyone. It was over 2,000 years ago that Roman statesman Marcus Tullius Cicero said that gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all others. And I think that's an important message for every week, but certainly this week. And it's a message not only for yourself, but to know that it resonates with those around you as you share it. So I implore you to be grateful and appreciative this week and every week. So on behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Thank you. Well, here we are again. As those of you who were here last week may have remembered, it was 774 days between October 2019 when we hosted the CEO of Tiffany's and last week with Bob Chapek, the CEO of Disney. And we decided 8 days apart was really the way to do it to get things rolling. So we're super excited to welcome our guest for the day. And with Thanksgiving just 2 days away, I do appreciate you coming out and sharing your valuable time with us. And while many understand the concept of gratitude, one of the things that I implore you to remember is that silent gratitude doesn't really count. It's important not only to be grateful for yourself, but to share that appreciation with those around you, with your friends, for their support, for their presence. And in a small way today, just in a simple gesture, I'd like to show some appreciation to the men and women here at the Boston Harbor Hotel who work so hard year-round, but certainly for our events to make these seem flawless. I can assure you behind the scenes, there's a little bit of mayhem. So on behalf of all of us and our members, please join me in thanking the men and women from the Boston Harbor Hotel. Stephen Johnson and his team does a fantastic job, and we're so thrilled to call this place our home for these events. Speaking of our events, as many of you will note on the back of the programs, and as I announced last week, we've got three confirmed dates coming up. On February 2nd, we'll be hosting Julie Sweet, the CEO of Accenture. Her host for the day will be Denise Morrison, the former CEO of Campbell Soup. On March 17th, John Pettigrew, the CEO of National Grid, will be joining us. And then finally, on April 4th, we have a rescheduled date with Stephen Bancel of Moderna. So we have quite a lineup with more to come later in the spring. At this point, I typically welcome and introduce our host for the day, Mike Mahoney of Boston Scientific. Mike, unfortunately, could not be with us today. He texted me yesterday, he's a little bit under the weather, and after much debate, we decided not to have him come here and infect the entire city of Boston the week of Thanksgiving. So Mike, if you're watching on Zoom, we miss you. Get better soon. We're very happy you're not here right now. So in his stead, I will be doing a poor replacement of hosting our keynote speaker. Our speaker today, as you all know, is Jamie Dimon. Jamie is the chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase & Company, a global financial services firm with assets of $3.2 trillion in operations worldwide. The firm is a leader in investment banking, financial services for consumers, small business, commercial banking, financial transaction processing, and asset management. Jamie began his career at American Express, and then his path took him to executive positions at Commercial Credit, the Travelers Corporation, Smith Barney, Salomon Brothers, and Citigroup. He was named CEO of J.P. Morgan in 2006 and chairman a year later. He was educated locally, earning his bachelor's degree at Tufts and his MBA at Harvard Business School. Finally, he proudly serves on the boards of directors of a number of nonprofit institutions, including the Business Roundtable, Bank Policy Institute, and Harvard Business School. Please join me in welcoming Jamie to our stage. Thank you. That's you and me. Perfect. So, welcome. You were scheduled to speak here in April of 2020, but two events forced us to reschedule. Obviously, the pandemic hit in March, but earlier that month, you had suffered a serious heart issue. Can you tell us a little bit about how that situation has had an impact on you, your outlook, both as a person and as a CEO?
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I appreciate the time. And I had what they call an aortic dissection. Most people don't survive it. I'm very lucky. The medical system, I called my doctor early in the morning. I knew something terrible was wrong. One of the best surgeons was available that morning. The guy, I knew what it was at one point, so I knew there was about 50-50, I'd get out of surgery. And the guy walks in, and I look at him and said, "You did my dad's triple bypass." And, there is a difference, okay? And it's hard for you to imagine this kind of, but you're all gonna die. You all know it. I really know it. I mean, it kind of walks beside me sometimes that how bad mortality is after going through something like that. But did it change my life? Not really. I think, I think it was the word purpose. I like having a purpose in life. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase is my purpose. The better I do here, the better I can make the world, the better I make it for employees. So that's kind of my purpose. You know, that hasn't changed. And so, and I just mentioned gratitude real quick. There is a little more gratitude about, like, I feel unbelievably blessed to have the people work at my company. You know, I feel unbelievably blessed to live in this country. And you should show it every day. My management team, I was doing a town hall recently, and it was with most of the employees, but in the room were a couple of my direct reports. And it was an employee appreciation day, and one of the employees stood up and asked a question I'd never been asked before. How do you show gratitude every day to your operating committee? And the people on the operating committee burst out laughing, because I don't. But I did say in the room, I said, I just want to know, they all know how much I love them, how much I respect them, how much I trust them, and maybe I should tell them more. And I did bring them little biscuits in a pink box recently. Though walking in with the biscuits, it occurred to me, they're supposed to be giving it to the boss. It's biscuits for the boss. Right, okay.
That's very Ted Lasso of you.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, of course, that's Ted Lasso, yeah.
So,
great show.
It's funny that you mentioned that as gratitude, because in doing my research, and everyone's excited to hear from you, the two things that I heard was driven data research, but this tremendous empathy and sincerity that everybody at your firm adores you, likes you. I had no negative response. I've spoken to people, everything is incredibly positive, and I find that fascinating that you're able to have sort of a foot on both sides of being demanding yet compassionate. And that's not something you see every day for someone in your position. How do you sort of manage that?
Yeah. Well, look, I think leadership has multiple parts, but to simplify a little bit, part is, you know, it's detail, facts, analysis, repeat, rinse. I've been in so many companies where they simply don't do that well. They just, you know, and it's not financial, it's operational, it's turnover, it's attrition, it's customer satisfaction, it's comparing to the competition, and you get better at it all the time. It doesn't stop because you did a good job. And very often people don't do it because it's undressing yourself. It's hard to do. It shows you that you're not doing particularly well in certain areas and stuff like that. But then, and obviously But the other side of it is what I call more like humility. And I don't mean humble. I mean, the fact is, when you move up an organization, you know less and less. So you know, like Steve Burbage is here. He knows more what's going on in some of these markets than I do. I got to call him if I want to know. And that, you know, as you all move up, you're not an expert. You're no longer an expert in what reports to you. You're an expert in a teeny sliver of it. And therefore, the job becomes much more and more like a coach, a player coach, getting the best out of people. You do not get the best out of people if they don't respect you. You do not get the best out of people if you weren't the foxhole of them. You don't get the best out of people if you don't work as hard as they do. And they know that I do everything every damn day relentlessly, and I am relentless about it, to do a better job for the company, the clients, and the employees, and no BS about it. And so I think you have to show compassion, because if you don't, if you're the kind of person who's blaming people, you know, hanging people, you've never seen me hang anyone out to dry. Never commented on it, never, even though I've asked people to leave, because I know it's their families and I don't want to embarrass them, and it tells everyone in the company that, you know, if you piss him off, you're going to be embarrassed publicly. And so so it is showing respect, gratitude, recognition. You don't know it all. You didn't do it all. You didn't build it all. You're just trying to make it better when you leave than it was when you got there.
And how did you maintain that during the pandemic when you weren't having all of your employees sort of in one central location, right? I mean, everyone here runs companies, organizations, and they had to struggle with maintaining that culture when we're looking in a camera on a computer from our couch.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit of a skeptic that this worked really well, by the way, the work from home stuff. So it was amazing. We all went home. Everyone in this room, you know, was able to go home, Zoom, start running and stuff. And we were all excited about it, like 12, 15 hours a day and on the Hollywood squares and getting back to people. And the tech teams got it working. And that erodes over time, because the excitement goes down. So we did it, but I don't think it's quite the same thing. I've been back to the office since last June. Not June, this last June, the June before that. I've been to 40 American cities. I've been to Europe 3 times, Mexico, Hong Kong. I never kind of stopped doing my job, as did the senior leader team. But I'll just give a quick story. So when I went out to California, this is now over a year ago, I was there for 2.5 days. I met 150 people, all outside, all very safe. But you're with your own people. I see my bankers in action. Clients tell me what they don't like about us, or why they didn't want to do this, or why they didn't pick us for this deal. I met, did a thing for 50 women, venture capitalists and CEOs of companies. I met with people who run Databricks and Snowflake and the cloud companies and AI, machine learning, cyber companies. 2.5 days, you go back, you're loaded with information, ideas, thoughts. You don't get that from Zoom. So all these folks who think that it works really great, and then managing, we all have an apprenticeship system. Younger kids need to be in the office to learn from you all. And then sales, you know, like talking to clients, all these things. So we managed it, but you could see over time that parts of it got worse. Some is measurable, some is more qualitative than quantitative, but I'm convinced it's there. Like, you know, tech people, I can do my work from home. Yeah, but the book of work went down. They're not inventing as much stuff. And so so we can keep it up. You know, it's great we're able to do it, but it has quite a few flaws in it.
So was it an erosion both of culture and financials, or was one hit harder?
Well, the financials, the JP Morgan boom, because our business boomed, not because we did anything great, but investment banking took off, trading took off, things took off. The government was pumping money everywhere, which drives volumes and stuff like that. So, our culture didn't erode because we're pretty relentless on it, but we hired 20,000 people who never met a JP Morgan person. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just mentioned that one trip to California. Well, think of all the trips we didn't have. So, you know, you just got to look at what didn't happen sometimes as opposed to what did happen. So I think when we all go back to work, there'll be more hybrid. I just don't think it's going to be everyone doing what they want and how great this is working at home and stuff like that. So, and also it's got to work for the company, the clients, not for me and my employees. It's got to work for you. And, you know, and also I tell people, you want to work 50% of the time in the office, but it's got to be at the right time with the other people. It doesn't work when I need you and you're not there. And not that it doesn't work for me, it doesn't work for the client. I need you, you're not there because you're home and I can't find you. So I get a lot of pushback on this. I called a lot of senior executives during this time period. I couldn't get them. And you can imagine I was quite irritated about it. If anyone you called my office any day, 24/7, you would have gotten an answer. Made no difference. And they knew exactly what it was and what I was doing and would get me just like that if they had to. And so there was a lot of erosion in some of these things.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned business was good. I'd love, as I'm sure the audience would, to get your current view of the U.S. economy and how we're doing versus the rest of the world, sort of a big picture
Yeah, so I'll do the U.S. So the U.S. is kind of booming. And it's set up for a while. The die's been cast. I'll give you exactly the reasons why. So we, right now, American consumers are spending 20 to 25% more than they were spending pre-COVID. They have $3 trillion more in their checking accounts because of government stimulus, et cetera, than they had pre-COVID. That's about 60% higher. They can spend at these higher levels for a sustained period of time before they get back to prior savings levels. The reason they're paying down debt is because they have so much damn money. So they paid down credit card debt and stuff like that. As opposed to 08, 09, which people use as an example, bad example, 08 and 09, the consumer was deleveraging massively because they were overleveraged in stocks, they were overleveraged in, through investments in hedge funds, they were overleveraged in mortgages. So the consumer's in great shape, and they are going to continue spending. So the data you see, which bounces all over the place, that underlying stuff is powerful. The second, businesses are in great shape. If you look at, like, I'm going to not talk about just large companies, but middle market companies, credit, almost never been better. Of their revolvers, which they have not paid off, they're using 25%. Average is 35%. High would be 45%. That number will go up as receivables and inventory and CapEx goes up and things like that. They're raring to go. They got plenty of capital, plenty of capability. They raise a lot of money in the markets. And we still have ongoing fiscal and monetary stimulus. So that is set up for a really strong environment. The data is going to bounce around. The growth will be pretty strong. What I just said is, think of roughly, Europe is about the same, 75%, 6 months behind. China will meet its 4 or 5% because they can. And all the other markets are kind of all over the place. But you kind of have this wave of growth coming. And it can be offset maybe some point down the road by the Fed. It will not be offset quickly. The Fed has made it totally clear they're not going to do anything to disrupt this thing. They want unemployment down to 4%. That's what they want. And so I think they're just keeping their foot off the brake until they see something like that.
So should we be worried about inflation, or are there other inhibitors to growth that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, well, the one you should kind of take off the table a little bit is geopolitics, because when you wake up every day, it scares the hell out of you. The world is kind of crazy. You got Iran. But if you look at geopolitical events, of the 50 or 60 since World War II, only one affected the global economy. Vietnam War didn't, Korean War didn't, 10 or 15 crises in the Middle East didn't, Afghanistan, multiple wars in Afghanistan didn't, Iraq didn't, India and Pakistan had a war, two nuclear power country didn't. I go on and on. Russia and right now, China and India having border skirmishes today. Russia and China had border skirmishes. China went to war in Vietnam. Russia went to everything. Only one, and that was the 74 oil crisis when oil went from 3 to 12. So people overreact to that, and obviously if you have something terrible somewhere, that can be different. But the big one is obviously inflation. You have inflation. I think the better way to think about it is it's at 5% today. So we're kind of growing around 4 or 5% real growth. Unemployment is going to come down. Is it 4.6? We think it's going to be at 4% in the next 6 months or so, and maybe even 3.5, which is the lowest it's ever been by the end of next year. And that's possible. And so inflation, think of it, it's 5%. Don't get involved in the debate, transitory or not transitory. Of course, a portion is transitory. So, my guess is that 5 is a point or two, which is transitory. Think of used car prices, lumber. But there are other things which are probably not that transitory. I don't think oil prices are going down. I think wage inflation is here for a while. I mean, there are 10.5 million open jobs. A bunch of people left the workforce. We don't have as much immigration. So it's not a shortage of labor. It's a good thing for labor, by the way. So I look at you all, the business people complain to me. We all said there's income inequality. We all wanted wages to go up for the poor people. Well, now it's happening, so stop complaining. And so it's a good thing, even though it may cause some slowdown. And by the way, we're growing this four, and so supply chain, some of that will go away. I don't think we'll be talking about supply chains in 12 months. I think it's just, CNN. In your face, they show you cargoes and ports lined up. Did you know that the port of LA works 12 hours a day and the port in Hong Kong works 24? No, now you know. And their capitalism is fixing these problems as we speak. So I think that one's gonna go away. We've been going to 4% with Delta and with supply chain problems. And that's the way you should look at it. 5% on inflation, the good news would be, I'll give you two scenarios. If it starts to come down next, think of next quarter, first quarter, second, third quarter next year, a little bit, and rates will go up. But if rates go to 3% by the end of next year, 3.5%, short rates go to 2.5, but we're growing really at 4% or so, everyone's going to be happy. That's not a big deal. It's not a burden to bear. Okay, the government will obviously have to pay more on its interest. I'm not giving you the bookends here. I'm giving you just two scenarios. I give about a third of a percent chance. And yeah, there's a third of a percent chance it's going to go next year to 5.5, 5.7, 6. You just got to prepare. And if that happens, the Fed will be forced to raise rates. So when they say, do they have the tools? Of course they have the tools. Removing money from the system and raising rates, but you're not going to like that one. You know, and that can slow down the economy and or push it into recession. Doesn't mean the recession is going to be painful long. And if we're down to 3.7% unemployment by the time it happens, maybe it'll just go back up to 5. But that, though, you have to prepare for those things. I do think the inflation is there, that part of that 5% is not temporary.
Are there other public policy measures that should be taken to ensure America's continued growth sort of in the global landscape?
Well, that's a really big question. This is my own personal view, okay, that America's grown 2% a year for 20 years. If you look at and I think the question we should ask ourselves is, what should it have been? And I think it should have been 3%. And I'm going to give you a list why it wasn't. And I'm not blaming any administration. And for 30 years, the lower income folks' incomes have not gone up. Okay, they have gone up with transfer payments, but not before transfer payments. And you know, transfer payments don't make people happy. They just make up for a shortcoming. And I look at it and I say, the reason America grew slow is we didn't build infrastructure. Our inner city schools don't work. Our healthcare system is 50 million uninsured, and it costs 18.5%. Best in the world, best pharma, best doctors, best hospitals, best surgeons, best people from all the world come here, but it's 18%, Europe is 9. That's an economic burden. People are not even living longer. It used to be part of productivity that people living longer, 50 million uninsured. Our regulatory systems cripples the formation of small business. One of the reasons you can't build infrastructure, regulations. Like to this, I don't know about Massachusetts, but the bunch of bridges I have studied you have the one over here. Even Larry Summers wrote about it. The bridge between Harvard and Harvard Business School took like a year or two to build, 7 years to refurbish. Because the rules, the requirements, whatever it is, we're not going to build those infrastructure if we don't fix that. And litigation, it costs 1% more as a percent of GDP than the rest of the world. If we had a better system, like justice was done, it's not. It's slow, expensive, capricious, and arbitrary. And we've done this to ourselves. And I call these things negative productivity factors. So if you're an economist, most economists don't say, well, how much did this hurt? Like take inner city schools, you know, like if these kids aren't graduating, I just came from, Mattapan. You know, and I was with Gerald a year up here, you know, getting these minority kids jobs. There are tons of jobs out there. You can do 12 weeks of coding, $65,000 a year, 12 weeks of learning how to code. And so I think we've done a lot of this to ourselves. And so my view, we needed infrastructure. The question I ask is, are we actually going to accomplish infrastructure? Not how much did you spend, which is what you read every day. How many miles did they build? How many highways? How many of these D bridges were rebuilt? Who's responsible? They gave some of the money to the states. They gave some of the money to this. Some of that money just disappears. It goes into pension plans and to pay off other deficits and stuff like that. So I'm count me a skeptic on the efficiency. Childcare, I love childcare. Income tax credit, I would double the damn thing. But will it be done well or will it be wasted? And every single one of these things, community college, make it free. The problem isn't the cost. The problem is a lot of the kids don't graduate, and a lot of them who graduate aren't prepared for a job. What we should be saying to ourselves is, we want those kids graduating at $65,000 a year. That's how you should measure me. And then we should assign responsibility. And so I think we are to blame ourselves for what I call the 2% growth, which, by the way, hurt the Black community, hurt the Latin community, hurt the poor community, because we didn't grow. And I think if our country doesn't like learn to put growth on the, and if you're a Democrat, particularly in Massachusetts, you damn well better put growth in the agenda, because this will get worse if we have slower growth and we can't compete as well with the rest of the world.
In 2020, J.P. Morgan Chase announced a $30 billion investment in racial equity, including building new branches in under-resourced areas. Of the 50 or so branches in Massachusetts, one's a community center branch, and you officially opened one this morning at Mattapan. Tell us about these branches and the decision to place New England's only community center branch in one of Boston's most vibrant communities. What is it about this region?
So I always knew about the bad policy stuff. I write about it every year and stuff like that. And we started a thing called Advancing Black Leaders internally because we're going through diversity numbers, and internally we're doing a great job of, and that, you know, they lump everything together. It goes back to discipline numbers. When you lump it together, you don't actually see what your problem is. So I had them disaggregate it, and we're doing great with women. Half my direct reports are women. We're doing great with Latin. We're doing great with LGBT. We're doing great with Asian. We were doing average with Black. That's a fact. By average for JP Morgan, better than most, but it was just, it wasn't like really good. We weren't setting JP Morgan pride behind it. And so we started a special effort called Advancing Black Leaders. We're now up 50% Black EDs and MDs. And by the way, I would say a lot of people here, you should be doing this too. And you know, you're not doing it at the expense of the white community if you do it the right way. Like, I'll tell you about this branch in 1 second. Then we advanced that to Advancing Black Leaders outside the company, Advancing Black Small Businesses, Advancing Black Pathways, like what Gerald does and stuff like that. And these things all work. There are a lot of work to get a company going. Then we had COVID and the murder of George Floyd. COVID and the murder of George Floyd told us something that we already knew, that when the shit hits the fan, like COVID or a recession, the poor people pay more. In this case, it was even more true because they're the ones who lost their jobs. Wasn't usually in a recession, you know, a lot of course, the whole income spectrum lose their jobs. And then the murder of George Floyd highlighted something new too, that the Black community has been 170 years since the Civil War, and we're not even close to parity. And it's a disgrace. And so we kind of redoubled down. The BRT, the 200 larger companies in America, you know, white CEOs said, we just got to do more. And so a lot of it is policies. It's education, it's infrastructure, it's healthcare. But it's also very specific, devoted efforts, in this case, for Black and Latinx community. So it's a big number, $30 billion. And that number is like $8 billion of mortgages. It's like $12 billion of affordable housing. It's $500 million of small business loans. But it actually takes place at the local level. So when I announce something like that, I know it's got to be done here. I saw Roxanne here too. Is she here? That it's the folks here who have to open branches, start the small business programs, start financial literacy programs, work with local affordable housing agencies, work with Gerald on hiring some of these Black kids, and which is very moving when you meet the some of these kids and stuff like that. And that's why we did it. And people are always skeptical. We announced after the first year what we said we were going to do, what we did do. We've already done 13 of the 30. Not everything worked. We're going to fine-tune some of the stuff like that. We're also doing things like, which Gerald mentioned, by the way, I had meant to mention before, that we got rid of a college degree required in a lot of jobs because it was a screen that was made no sense. You know, because we were hiring kids to be tellers who had college degrees, but they didn't want to be a teller. So you just end up having high attrition and things like that. So we eliminated that weekend. We got rid of banned the box, so you don't have to say whether you've had a criminal. We started special programs for a second chance, ex-felons, not violent. You know, people have done stupid things when they're kids, which a lot of us did too. And all these things work, you know, they're hard work. If you're in an organization, the hardest part is getting it going. And we've had enormous support in the organization. And so I can go on and on about these special problems. Like then we started, there was an article in the paper, and sometimes articles aren't, you know, we think they're wrong, but there's a truth to it. And this was an article called Banking While Black. And it was how a Black person was mistreated at a JPMorgan Chase branch. It was partially true, but it also highlighted something when I was reading it. I called up the poor and said, you did a good job. You weren't completely right, but you did a good job. So like we don't have enough Black financial advisors. We have a special program to hire and train them because there aren't a lot of existing Black financial advisors. We said, okay, fine. We're going to go right to schools and hire ourselves and then put them in the Black neighborhoods. So a lot of this wealth effect for the Black community is lack of home ownership. So we're trying to do special things on home ownership around, you know, they don't do redlining anymore, but there are problems with appraisals and credit scores and stuff like that. And then getting people to save. Financial literacy, getting people to save and putting Black advisors in Mattapan. So they can welcome their own folks in and teach them how to do some of that. And so there are a million things we can all do to make it better. And I think if we make it better, the country will be better off. I think the pain and suffering of this income inequality, the racial inequality, I think it's bad for all of us. I don't think it's just bad for them.
I'll open it up in a second for questions from the audience. But my last question before I do, it sort of builds on what you just said. Your passion is obvious. How is a CEO decide on when to make your opinions known on a social issue versus not?
Well, you know, some are easy. First of all, we spend a lot of time thinking about what we're going to do or not do. It's not just me guessing. I have a lot of people we talk about. We debate it all the time. And there's certain things we I said, absolutely not. We're getting involved with that. You know, someone's on TV saying we should tell you that you can't buy a gun with our credit cards. Well, I can't tell you what to do with your checking account. That's terrible. Plus, I don't know what you're buying. I just know what store you're in. So if it's called Joe's Gun Store, well, yeah. You know how many shops sell guns? 40,000. I can't tell you what to drink. I can't tell you whether you should smoke or not. And so, I mean, we don't go there. LGBT issues, absolutely. We tell our employees, we want you, whether you're white, black, Jewish, Asian, Muslim, LGBT, disabled, et cetera, we want you to feel treated with respect and decency here. And there we will fight in courts to do the right thing for that group. I'm unabashed about it. And then we get involved sometimes, and you know, we don't get involved much in other things, but we try to decide where it makes sense. I do think it's very important, I mentioned those policy issues, that companies get involved in that. I don't think they're solvable alone by government. We need good government, but what I said, education, infrastructure, and the other thing about business, I'm sure the governor sees this all the time, it is disgraceful to me how often business goes into capitals of states or capitals of the world, and it's all about what they want for themselves. Tax breaks, millions of tax breaks. A lot of you probably get private equity carried interest. It's a disgrace, okay? I think the Democrats want to put back salt. It's a disgrace. Maybe it would benefit me tremendously, but it's a disgrace. There are tax breaks for golf courses. Really? Cotton, sugar, corn, ethanol, racehorses. What are we doing? And this creates that swamp that the American public, they look at that swamp. It's not just business. You go to Washington, the biggest building across from the White House is the AFL-CIO. And I respect unions, you know, but there's 17,000 lobby groups down there all fighting for their own thing. So I guess my point is when you get involved in public policy, when you walk in, the first thing should be what's good for the country. And if the country does better, if we had that 3% growth, the benefit of that would dwarf the benefit of your individual tax breaks. And so I think that we got to get ourselves saying, you know, the country first, and then you can debate what you're doing for else. When I took over the BRT, I became the chairman. I told them all, it was a group bigger than this one, but I said, I'll never talk about bank regulations, ever. It's just about what's good for the country. And we have, you know, bank lobbying groups who can worry about some of those other things.
There are microphones out here. I welcome your questions for our guest. Yeah, it's on its way, Carl. Yeah, we know, but we want everyone to hear your insight.
So, geopolitical and talking about what's good for the country. Jamie, what is your thought about doing business in China and Taiwan and what that means to the future? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so let me put Taiwan separately.
Okay.
And, you know, first of all, it's foreign policy. That's the government's job. The America has this ambiguous policy about, we believe in one China, but we'll help Taiwan defend itself. That does not necessarily mean with our blood, but it does mean with our treasure, like, you know, arms and stuff like that. No one I know thinks that something's going to go wrong in Taiwan. This is all, what's it called, like, you know, just saber rattling or something like that. Some people think that President Xi, before he leaves, will want to take over Taiwan as a legacy type of issue. You got to be very careful. Them doing something in Taiwan could be their Vietnam. Body bags in any country have an adverse effect at one point, particularly when the objective may be irrelevant. And so I think people have to be very careful about what they're going to do. And I think it would be very painful for the Chinese to do it. So they're very smart people. Hopefully that will not become an issue. I prefer what President Deng used to say, which is, let's agree to disagree for 100 years. You know, we don't need to shed a lot of blood over Taiwan. China itself is a very complicated issue. So about 10 years ago, and I'm going to be critical of all of us in this one, we should have taken this more seriously. So all of us in the business community, kind of we were happy to be there and let us in and things were going slowly. And President Obama came to a BRT meeting and said, you guys complain to me all the time about China, but whenever I try to do something, say, back off, don't pressure them on that. Because China is very good at cherry picking. They got you to come in, they gave Procter & Gamble this, they gave this one this. But over time, it was going south. IP, subsidies to state-owned enterprises, all the lack of bilateral investment rights. You know, so Trump was right about China. He got the support of the business community because it was time to do something about it. But what we need is a very detailed strategic economic dialogue, including trade and all those other things, away from foreign policy. America, I like that the Biden administration is reaching out the hands with civility. I think we should be doing this with the Japanese, the Australians, and the Europeans, and the UK now is in, around trade and economic, and tell them, here's, we want you to be part of the system, but we will not allow these things. And you can go one by one. So countries can make unilateral decisions. They've made some of their own. We've made some, like Huawei. That's fine. National security takes preference. But my view is that over time, there'll be a little bit of a, it won't be a decoupling, it'll be a restructuring. Part has already happened. You know, I was surprised to find how many people reliant on China as their sole vendor. That kind of caught me off guard a little bit. But I think it's going to be okay. It's complicated. And this is where it's complicated about freedom of speech. So you, you know, the Chinese made noise at one point about, I don't have freedom of speech in China, like, which is true before, by the way, like I have in Hong Kong, I don't have in Hong Kong anymore either. But if they start to tell you what you can say here because you do business in China, that's the problem. They haven't done it. They're very smart. They're very thoughtful. The other thing about China, you got to do a full assessment. Okay, America has all the foodborne energy it needs. They don't. We are at peace with our neighbors and haven't had a war since 1848. They've had three since 1848. We've got Canada, Mexico, Atlantic, and the Pacific. Wonderful neighbors. They have the Philippines, Japan, the Koreas, Indonesia, Vietnam, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, and Russia. They've had war with two borders going to three of them recently. Okay, we have the gifts of our founding fathers, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, if you freedom of enterprise, freedom of human capital, immigration. If you opened up the doors of America, 1 billion people would come here. If you open the doors of China, how many people think would go there? And so people should be a little careful when they think that China is ascendant that way. The GDP per person is 15,000. Ours is 60. Ours would be 120 when theirs is 45 or 50. Okay, so our demographics are better. Autocratic macro-manager economy doesn't work particularly well as a country gets much more sophisticated. And I'm not saying this to be angry to China. I think they've done a better job managing that country than we would have done managing that country. They are very smart. You go to China, they know who you are. They know what you've done. They've investigated. They come to schools here. They think things through. You know, they're feeling their oats. They look at us now as the kind of the incompetent nation. You know, it's not just January 6th. It's just all the things I mentioned, that America can't get out of its own underwear and stuff like that. But this is not over. I mean, I tell people, take a deep breath, but we need leadership. And I'm hoping the Biden administration provides it. I mean, I think Trump wasn't wrong. I detest a lot of things Trump said. He wasn't wrong about WTO and NATO and China. I wouldn't have done things the way he did them, you know. But this is probably the most serious issue going forward. The other thing is, J.P. Morgan can't go to a country and go in and out every time we like or don't like something the government's doing. I'd leave America, wouldn't I? Okay, so you better be real careful about when you say public policy in foreign countries. I'm a patriot. I stand behind the American government. The American government wouldn't want me to leave. So, you know, maybe a couple of senators are going to say, J.P. Morgan, they shouldn't do business in China because of A, B, and C. That's not, we're in Russia. We're in Pakistan. We're in Egypt. You know, and we're there for the people of the country. We're very consistent. We hope to be there for a long time. I made a joke the other day that I was just in Hong Kong that I made a joke that the Communist Party is celebrating its 100th year. So is J.P. Morgan. And I'll make you bet we last longer. I can't say that in China. They probably are listening anyway.
Hey, Jamie. Michael Woodall, Putnam Investments. First of all, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here. Second of all, your energy is contagious. And my question to you is, you talked about a sense of purpose. I'm curious how your sense of purpose has evolved over your career, maybe the past 10 or 15 years.
You know, I didn't think about it that much. Like, I started working and I was just gung-ho working, trying to build a company. And by that company you mentioned, it was one company. I was fired. So that goes back to leadership too. I wear the jersey of the company. I've been offered more money. I can go do other stuff. I worked at Commercial Credit, bought Primerica, merged with Travelers, merged with Citi. And I was the president and chief operating most of that time. Then I was fired by Sandy Weill. So I'm a jersey guy. I put on the jersey of the company. I just want to build it. And I do think now I will say the purpose, you know, the better, this is my purpose. I mean, if I have family, so I have a binary life. I do work and family, and my kids sometimes say, Dad, you don't have any hobbies. I say, yes, I do. You. We travel. We barbecue. I love history. I love wine. We love cooking. I read everything. I love tennis, which I can't play anymore for a whole bunch of different reasons. But That's what I do. But the purpose is them. I think they're damn great citizens, and in their own way, I never asked them to go into business or anything like that, but walk on this earth and leave behind it better than you found it. And then JP Morgan, which is, if this is a healthy and vibrant company, and by, I have a lot of respect for companies that aren't, because I pointed out, we can afford all the stuff I'm talking about. Like if you're running like US Steel, it's tough. They can't afford all that right now. They're fighting for survival. And I completely understand it's a different ball game. And I think the public, you know, maybe the Senate doesn't understand, but the public kind of does. And but that purpose is, I can make this a better world. I serve my clients. The shareholders are doing well. The employees are doing well. If I grow the company, the employees get opportunity. They can get paid more. They can, you know, some of the people's second homes, they tell me that's the house that Jamie built, you know, and it kind of is, and I feel great about it, you know. But we also get involved in public policy and hiring black kids and, you know, working with great governors and mayors, and I love it. You know, that's what I love doing, and that's the most I can do. I would have, if you had told me about the political situation, I might have gone into politics 10 years ago. But it's too late for me. And I'm not sure I've been good at it, so.
Kane?
Jamie, thanks for being here. A number of large companies have announced allocations into cryptocurrency. How has your thinking evolved on cryptocurrencies and what impact it might have on the global economy in the future?
Yeah, so blockchain is real. It's a technology. We've been talking about blockchain now for 12 or 15 years, and there's been very little of it. So I tell people, again, take a deep breath. You know, CNBC loves to just mention stuff over and over. It's real. We use it for information sharing and, you know, cross-border transactions. It can't be used for certain things. Like, as we speak, we're zipping $1 trillion around the world in little increments, large increments. We're doing 1,000 FX trades, equity trades in a split second electronically. It takes minutes to update a blockchain. And it costs $2 or $5, whatever it is. That we do this in a second and it costs nothing. The money we move moves across, you know, our AML systems, our OFAC systems, our sanction systems, our risk systems. But blockchain is real. Parts of DeFi are real. Stablecoin is kind of like a money market fund. You know, so issues there. I think it'll all be regulated. The crypto tokens, and you should call it a token, you know, it's not really a currency, that have unsupported value, no intrinsic value, buyer beware. I've seen this before. I know this hysteria, but remember, all this fiscal stimulus, you've never seen ever in this life the fiscal monetary stimulus that was put in the system the last 2 years, ever. We see money going from stimulus checks to a checking account to Robinhood to Bitcoin. And don't tell me they're sophisticated investors. And so I if you're going to diversify, I diversify very carefully and very modestly. I'm not going to do it, of course.
Thank you for being here. Quick question about your rollout of the local branches in disadvantaged communities. First of all, thank you, because I think we're going to open one in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which would be great. How's it going, and would you encourage other folks to use that model?
You're talking about overseas or here?
Here in the United States.
The branch expansion is going great. We're now in 48 states. I'd wanted to do it 10 years earlier. The regulators wouldn't let me. I told the regulators at the time that, you know, you're not hurting me, you're hurting your country. That the 400 extra branches we've opened, you know, are 4,000 jobs directly, 12,000 indirectly, $1 billion of capital spend. And when we come into town, we bring mortgages, small business, private banking, the community branch. And those community branches, we hire local people. They use local vendors and local mortgages and local financial advice. And it's great. I mean, I wish some people go see how excited our people are in those branches. Pumped up, excited, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, raring to go. This kid told a story how Gerard actually saved him, and he now works for us in Plano, Texas, of all places, but he grew up here. And you know, he had seen, it made me feel good, because he said he saw a 60 Minutes episode that I did with Gerald, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. And of course, doing those things are kind of painful. You know, but his grandmother saw it, told his mother, who said, "That's what you should do. You're up." And it just made me feel great, because that one kid, one soul. And he says without that, he probably would have been a lost soul. So I just, you know, those things matter, and, you know, it's one branch at a time.
We have time for one more question. Is there anyone who's...
Thanks. You had mentioned one thing that kind of stuck out. You said country first is a path forward. You'd also talked a little bit about if you could turn the clock back 10 years and be in politics. Just in a time where there's such polarization, what do you think the ability to move to a country first approach is? And just what are your thoughts overall?
If I use the word country first, I shouldn't have, because I'm not saying that implies something I didn't mean to imply. I'm a patriot. I think when we go into capitals of the country, we should talk about what's right for the country. That, so I'm putting the country just above my own interests. I think it's, and I do think, political leaders come along will change everything. If Warren Buffett was here, he would tell you the resiliency is unbelievable. He'd tell you about the Civil War, the Depression, and World War I and World War II, and leaders come forth, and they're born, or they're made, they're wonderful things, and that'll change. Something changes it. Now, that I hope that's true. I don't like the political discourse. Of course, when I listen to both Democrats and Republicans and the yelling at each other, you know what they're saying half the time? They don't like what the people voted for. I'm against what the people voted for, therefore, I'm angry. But that's what the people voted for. And so I think people have to be very cautious about when they talk about partisanship, because the liberals don't like what the Republicans say or do, but the Republicans won a lot of elections. And maybe they should read that, and vice versa, by the way, and stuff like that. I should say before about this America First, Trump used to say something like that. It is critical for the world. Like if you talk about the biggest risk to the world, I would mention nuclear proliferation, terrorism, and cyber, but above all of that is American policy. If America is good and strong and moral and proper and does things right, we can fix all those problems, including climate. If America is discombobulated, you're pretty much going to have global chaos. And a lot of the folks around the world don't want to partner up with Russia and China. They may have no other choice. Now, that America we need to take a global leadership role for us. And it doesn't have to be the ugly American, our way or the highway. Like we have these terrible trade debates with the Mexicans and the Canadians. I used to call, NAFTA. I used to call it not NAFTA 2.0, but NAFTA 0.8. With all that debate, it didn't change that much. But we were fighting with the Canadians over $100 million of certain cheese they sell here. We don't have the, America is bigger than that. And we need to work with the allies to set trade and policy and NATO, and some of the conversations should be private and stuff like that. But the world would be better off with American leadership. There is no one else who can do it. We may have made mistakes in some of these foreign wars, okay, which cost us $4 trillion. I should put that down as a, I can't see how they create productivity, okay? And so we should be careful. We should be judicious in the use of power and stuff like that. Bob Gates wrote a book called The Exercise of Power, and the last chapter is called The Symphony of Power, and judicious use, but that power is also diplomatic. Foreign aid, immigration, discourse and culture, that power isn't just the military is going to make up for everything else. And so America needs to lead. And I'm quite optimistic about the future, because you read sometimes these kids, they're going to not going to have jobs. The kids, your kids and grandkids are going to live to 100, not have any of the pain and suffering we all went through. When I was a kid, you went to the dentist, you didn't get Novocaine. It was painful. It was cold. My grandparents didn't have heating and cooling. When they came here from Greece, because they were all Greek immigrants, they had no money. Your kids are going to inherit a country worth hundreds of trillions of dollars. They don't have that much to complain about. Okay, now it may be intergenerational. Obviously, we have the poor folks that aren't going to inherit a lot of that. There's a lot to do here, but the country will have a great future as long as we are good at it. And we being people in this room, and then people, the next generation.
Well, I was going to ask, yes, I can. Thank you. Our organization went virtual for the past 18 months, and we did a bunch of interviews online. And I always ended the conversation asking the guest to leave us with a message of hope, something that we can walk away from feeling good about ourselves, our lives, our future, the country. I think you've given much of that in your last answer, but is there anything that you'd like to add to that to give us a positive message of hope as we leave this room today?
I would just keep the faith. keep working, keep the faith, and hopefully things will get better. And by the way, 2 years ago, we had 15% unemployment and no vaccine. And now we're complaining that wages are going up too much. We're in pretty good shape.
Fantastic. Well, on behalf of the Boston College Chief Executive Club.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Jamie Dimon, Chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.